This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won, by Victor Davis Hansen, narrated by Bob Sauer. Preface. The more than three dozen missions carried out by my father, William F. Hansen, in a B-29 bomber over Japan, were a world apart from his cousin's experience. Victor Hansen's war ended in a fatal May 19, 1945 rendezvous with a Nambu machine gun nest on the crest of Sugarloaf Hill with the 6th Marine Division on Okinawa. Both fought in a way foreign to their other cousin, Robert Hansen, who worked as a logistician in Iran, ferrying American military freight to the Russians. All three Hansons experienced different wars from that of my maternal cousin, Richard Davis. He rolled across France as part of Patton's Third Army. Dick's war, in turn, was unlike that of another maternal cousin, Belden Cather. As a boy, I remember an occasionally feverish Belden on the farm as a lifelong semi-invalid, suffering neurological disabilities from serial bouts with dengue fever contracted while fighting in the Pacific. Belden did not battle in the same manner or against the same enemies or in the same places as his brother Holt, killed while serving in combat with an artillery battalion of the 7th Army in November 1944 and buried in France at the Epinal American Cemetery. World War II sent the youth of American, British, German, Japanese, Italian, and Russian families across the globe in odd alliances against each other. They battled in the air, at sea, and on the ground for all sorts of expressed reasons, employing machines that were often new and fighting in ways still not fully understood, and against a variety of enemies. When the veterans of my family shared stories about their service at holiday gatherings in the early 1960s, we eavesdroppers listened to their descriptions of exotic locales and situations, wondering whether they had even fought in the same war. They insisted that they were kindred soldiers in a shared struggle against a common evil with a variety of faces. How fighting different enemies alongside disparate allies in greatly different ways across the globe coalesced into one war is a paradox, and the subject of this book. Its aim is to explain why a single conflict encompassed global fighting in ways not true of most prior wars, fought in limited locales between predictable enemies and through familiar methods. I titled this book The Second World Wars for two reasons. One, no supposedly single conflict was ever before fought in so many diverse landscapes on premises that often seemed unrelated. And two, never had a war been fought in so many different ways, to the extent that a rocket attack on London, or jungle fighting in Burma, or armor strikes in Libya seemed to belong to entirely different wars. World War II, however, began traditionally enough in 1939 and 1940 in Europe as a series of border conflicts exclusively between European powers, including Britain. As is true of much of European history, aggressive states attacked their perceived weaker neighbors, usually through surprise and in reliance on greater preparation and armament. By the end of 1940, what had so far seemed to be familiar European infighting had achieved a Caesarean or Napoleonic scale. But by the end of 1941, something quite cataclysmic followed. All the smaller conflicts compounded unexpectedly into a total global war, in which the Axis powers of Germany, Italy, and Japan were soon materially outmatched, strategically unprepared, and likely to lose in catastrophic fashion. Advances in Western technology and industrialization, when married with both totalitarian zealotry and fully mobilized democratic states, also ensured that the expanded war would become lethal in a way never before seen. Three unexpected events explain why the border fights that had begun periodically, and sometimes ended and started again, between 1939 and 1941, were no longer seen as a series of separate wars, but had coalesced and become redefined as part of what we now know as World War II in the United States, or as the Second World War in the Anglosphere. First, Germany, without warning, invaded its partner, the Soviet Union, June 22, 1941. Second, in addition to its long war with China, Japan took on new enemies by conducting surprise attacks on the Pacific and Asian bases of Great Britain and the United States, December 7th and 8th, 1941. Third, both Germany and Italy then declared war against the Americans, December 11th, 1941. Only these unforeseen developments in the single year of 1941 recalibrated prior regional conflicts in Europe and Asia into a continuous and now interconnected global war that drew in three new powerful participants, Japan, the Soviet Union, and the United States, into the two formidable alliances with a vast array of aircraft carriers, sophisticated planes, artillery pieces, and vehicles. The new worldwide fight was rebranded as one of Germany, Italy, and Japan against Britain, the Soviet Union, the United States, and China, with smaller and weaker allied states on both sides. Thus, the holistic idea of a Second World War was born. Despite the wartime propagandas that followed, there were few common fault lines of religion, race, or geography to make sense of this confusing conflict, much less common methods of conducting the fighting. Being victims of Axis aggression, most often through unprovoked attacks, was about the only common bond that held the Allies together, a tripartite alliance that initially hinged on retaliating against Adolf Hitler, and that thus dissipated months after his death almost as quickly as it had been formed. This book does not follow a strict chronological sequence, nor does it offer a comprehensive narrative history of all the diverse theaters and campaigns of the war. Rather, it focuses on particular battles emblematic of the larger themes of how the respective belligerents made wise and foolish choices about why, how, and where to fight the war. It is not, then, an operational history of the war that provides detailed accounts of day-by-day fighting, advances, and retreats. Instead, the book's chapters analyze the diverse methods and effectiveness of combat, the role of civilians, industry, air power, navies, infantry, armor, siegecraft, and military leadership, to assess how these different investments and strategies led one side to win and the other to lose, and how the war's diverse theaters, belligerents, and ways of fighting came eventually to define a single war. A general theme also transcends the chapters. The once ascendant Axis powers were completely ill-prepared, politically, economically, and militarily, to win the global war they had blundered into during 1941. Simply killing the far greater number of soldiers and civilians over the next 4 years, the vast majority of them Russians, Eastern Europeans, and Chinese, never equated to destroying their enemy's ability to make war. Victor Davis Hansen, Selma, California, March 2017. Part 1. Ideas. When, where, and why did they fight? In a war of ideas, it is people who get killed. Stanisław Jerzy-Lietz. 1. The war in a classical context. Some 60 million people died in World War II. On average, 27,000 people perished on each day between the invasion of Poland, September 1, 1939, and the formal surrender of Japan, September 2, 1945. Bombed, shot, stabbed, blown apart, incinerated, gassed, starved, or infected. The Axis losers killed or starved to death about 80% of all those who died during the war. The Allied victors largely killed Axis soldiers, the defeated Axis mostly civilians. More German and Russian soldiers were killed in tanks at Kursk, well over 2,000 tanks lost, than at any other battle of armor in history. The greatest loss of life of both civilians and soldiers on a single ship, 9,400 fatalities, occurred when a Soviet submarine sank the German troop transport Wilhelm Gustloff in the Baltic Sea in January 1945. The costliest land battle in history took place at Stalingrad. Leningrad was civilization's most lethal siege. The death machinery of the Holocaust made past mass murdering from Attila to Tamerlane to the Aztecs seem like child's play. The deadliest single day in military history occurred in World War II during the March 10, 1945 firebombing of Tokyo, when 100,000 people, perhaps many more, lost their lives. The only atomic bombs ever dropped in war immediately killed more than 100,000 people at Hiroshima and Nagasaki together, most of them civilians, while tens of thousands more ultimately died and were maimed from radiation exposure. World War II exhausted superlatives. Its carnage seemed to reinvent ideas of war altogether. Yet how, why, and where the war broke out were predictable factors. The sophisticated technology and totalitarian ideologies of World War II should not blind us to the fact that the conflict was fought on familiar ground in predictable climates and weather by humans whose natures were unchanged since antiquity, and thus who went to war, fought, and forged a peace according to time-honored precepts. Reformulated ancient ideas of racial and cultural superiority fueled the global bloodbath between 1939 and 1945, which was ostensibly started to prove that some ideologies were better, or at least more powerful, than others. Nazi Germany certainly believed that other, supposedly inherently spiritually weaker Western nations, Britain and France in particular, had conspired since World War I to prevent the expression of naturally dominant German power. In his memoirs, Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, commander-in-chief of the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, after January 1943, summed up accurately the German justification for the war. Britain went to war in 1939 because Greater Germany, growing in strength and united with Austria, was becoming a menace to British imperial and economic interests. Notice how Dönitz's key phrase, "Britain went to war," assumes that the German invasion of Poland was the result of victimization and grievance, and thus should not have provoked a wider war. By 1939, Germans had concluded that the post-war policies of the Western European nations were unfair, vindictive, and with some tolerable sacrifices, correctable, given the rebirth of Germany under a uniquely powerful National Socialism. An unfettered Germany would establish hegemony throughout Europe, even if that effort might require dramatic changes in current borders, substantial population exchanges, and considerable deaths, though mostly of non-Germans. In time, both fascist Italy, which had invaded both Ethiopia and Albania prior to September 1, 1939, and Japan, which had invaded China well over 2 years before the German attack on Poland, felt that if Hitler could take such risks, as he had throughout 1939 through 1941 in apparently successful fashion, then they too might take a gamble to share in the spoils. Perceived self-interest and a sense of the ancient Greek historian Thucydides' realist notion of honor and fear, as much as ideological affinity, explained which power entered the war, or left it, or chose to remain neutral. World War II was conceived and fought as a characteristic Western war in which classical traditions of free markets, private property, unfettered natural inquiry, personal freedom, and a secular tradition had for centuries often translated to greater military dynamism in Europe than elsewhere. If the conflict's unique savagery and destructiveness can only be appreciated through the lenses of 20th century ideology, technology, and industry, its origins and end still followed larger contours of conflict as they developed over 2,500 years of civilized history. The Western military's essence had remained unchanged, but it was now delivered at an unprecedented volume and velocity and posed a specter of death on a massive scale. The internecine war was largely fought with weaponry and technology that were birthed in the West, although also used by westernized powers in Asia. The atomic bombs, napalm, guided missiles, and multi-engine bombers of World War II confirmed a general truth that for over two millennia the war-making of Europe and its appendages had proven brutal against the non-West. But when its savage protocols and technology were turned upon itself, the corpses mounted in an unfathomable fashion. Starting wars is far easier than ending them. Since the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404 BC, between Athens and Sparta and their allies, winning and finishing a war was predicated on finding ways to end an enemy's ability to fight, whether materially or psychologically. The Axis and the Allies had radically different ideas of how the wars of World War II would eventually conclude, with the Allies sharing a far better historical appreciation of the formulas that always put a final end to conflicts. When World War II broke out in 1939, Germany did not have a serious plan for defeating any of those enemies, present or future, that were positioned well beyond its own borders. Unlike its more distant adversaries, the Third Reich had neither an adequate Blue Water Navy nor a strategic bombing fleet, anchored by escort fighters and heavy bombers of four engines, whose extended ranges and payloads might make vulnerable the homelands of any new enemies on the horizon. Hitler did not seem to grasp that the four most populous countries or territories in the world, China, India, the Soviet Union, and the United States, were either fighting against the Axis or opposed to its agendas. Never before or since had all these peoples, well over 1 billion total, fought at once and on the same side. Not even Napoleon had declared war in succession on so many great powers without any idea how to destroy their ability to make war or, worse yet, in delusion that tactical victories would depress stronger enemies into submission. Operation Sea Lion, Germany's envisioned invasion of Britain, remained a pipe dream, and yet it offered the only plausible way to eliminate Britain from the war that Hitler had started. Grand Admiral Erich Raeder, then head of the Kriegsmarine, repeatedly warned Hitler that an amphibious invasion of Britain in 1940 was quite impossible, after explaining why the German Navy was unable to transport hundreds of thousands of troops across the Channel. Raeder flatly concluded, "I could not recommend a landing in England." After the war, Field Marshal General Wilhelm Keitel agreed that the military was not up to the task and was relieved that Hitler finally conceded as much. "I very much worried. I fully realized that we would have to undertake this invasion with small boats that were not seaworthy. Therefore, at that time, I had fully agreed with the decision of the Führer." The invasion of Russia, codenamed Operation Barbarossa, would prove a rerun of the early successes of Blitzkrieg in precisely the one theater where it would be nearly impossible to conduct it effectively, an operation that Raeder in hindsight claimed to have opposed, desperately but vainly advising Hitler that under no circumstances should we go to war with Russia. War's eternal elements, a balance between powers, deterrence versus appeasement, collective security, preemption and preventive attacks, and peace brought by victory, humiliation, and occupation, still governed the conflict. As was true in most past conflicts, the publics in Axis countries, regardless of the odiousness of fascist ideology, supported the war when Germany, Italy, and Japan were deemed to be winning. Even the liberal German historian Friedrich Meinecke was caught up in the German euphoria following the sudden collapse of France in 1940. And to have regained Strasbourg, how could a man's heart not beat a little faster at this? After all, building up an army of millions in the space of only 4 years and rendering it capable of such achievements has been an astonishing and arguably the greatest and the most positive accomplishment of the Third Reich. The classical Greek historian Thucydides, who so often focused on the Athenian public's wild shifts in reaction to perceived battlefield victories or defeats, could not have captured any better the mercurial exhilaration at the thought of decisive military success. The pulse of the war also reflected another classical dictum. The winning side is the one that most rapidly learns from its mistakes, makes the necessary corrections, and most swiftly responds to new challenges, in the manner that land power Sparta finally built a far better navy, while the maritime Athenians never fielded an army clearly superior to its enemies, or the land power Rome's galleys finally became more effective than were the armies of the sea power Carthage. The Anglo-Americans, for example, more quickly rectified flaws in their strategic bombing campaign by employing longer-range fighter escorts, recalibrating targeting, integrating radar into air defense networks, developing novel tactics, and producing more and better planes and crews than did Germany in its bombing against Britain. America would add bombers and crews at a rate unimaginable for Germany. The result was that during 6 months of the Blitz, September 1940 to February 1941, the Luftwaffe, perhaps the best strategic bombing force in the world in late 1939 through mid-1940, dropped only 30,000 tons of bombs on Britain. In contrast, in the half-year between June and November 1944, Allied bombers dropped 20 times that tonnage on Germany. The same asymmetry was true at sea, especially in the Battle of the Atlantic. The Allied leadership made operational changes and technological improvements of surface ships and planes far more rapidly than could the U-boats of the Kriegsmarine. America adapted to repair and produce aircraft carriers and train new crews at a pace inconceivable in Japan. The Allies, including the Soviet Union on most occasions, usually avoided starting theater wars that ended in multi-year infantry quagmires. In contrast, Japan, Germany, and Italy respectively bogged down in China, the Soviet Union, and North Africa and the Balkans. The importance of the classical geography of war is also unchanging. Ostensibly, the Mediterranean should not have mattered in a 20th century war that broke out in Eastern Europe. The nexus of European power and influence had long ago shifted far northward, following the expansion of hostile Ottoman power into the Western Mediterranean, the discovery of the New World, the Reformation, the British and French Enlightenments, and the Industrial Revolution. But the Mediterranean world connected three continents and had remained even more crucial after the completion of the Suez Canal for European transit to Asia and the Pacific. The Axis spine was predicated on a north-south corridor of fascist-controlled rail lines connecting ports on the Baltic with those on the Mediterranean. Without the Mediterranean, the British Empire could not easily coordinate its global commerce and communications. It was no wonder, then, that North Africa, Italy, and Greece became early battlegrounds, as did the age-old strategic stepping stones across the Mediterranean at Crete, Malta, and Sicily that suffered either constant bombing or invasions. British, American, Italian, and German soldiers often found themselves fortifying or destroying the Mediterranean stonework of the Romans, Byzantines, Franks, Venetians, and Ottomans. Gibraltar still remained unconquerable. Without a viable plan to attack it on land and from its Iberian rear, the Axis gave up taking the fortress, as had every aggressor that had coveted it since the British annexation of 1713. That Germany and Italy would try to wage war on the Mediterranean and in North Africa without serious attempts to invade Gibraltar and Malta is a testament to their ignorance of history. Still, other classical precedents were forgotten. Western military history showed, but was apparently again dismissed by Allied planners, that it was often difficult to start a campaign northward up the narrow backbone of the Italian peninsula. What usually started in Sicily petered out in mid-peninsula, given the ease of defense in the narrow mountainous terrain of the Apennines with seas on both flanks. Hannibal and Napoleon alone seemed to have believed that Italy was best conquered from the north rather than the south. Nor had Europeans ever had much success trying to attack Russia from the west. Despite the grand efforts of Swedes, French, and Germans, the expanses were always too wide, the barriers too numerous, the window of good weather too brief, and the Russians were too many and too warlike on their own soil. Planes and tanks did not change those realities. Germany's problem in particular was that its two most potent enemies, Britain and Russia, were also the hardest to reach. While Germany's Central European location was convenient for bullying the French and Eastern Europeans, its British and Russian existential enemies enjoyed both land and sea buffers from the vaunted German army. The Allies were surprised that Hitler staged two invasions through the Ardennes in southeast Belgium. But in addition to the examples of World War I, the critically located rough terrain had been a nexus for passing armies since it was first mentioned in Caesar's Gallic Wars and later became a favorite campaign ground of Charlemagne. Invading a united Britain historically had also usually proved a bad idea. Not since the Romans and William the Conqueror had any military seriously tried an amphibious landing on the British coasts. Far more easily, the British and their allies, from the Hundred Years' War to World War I, landed troops on the European Atlantic coastline, which, being longer, was harder to defend and not often politically united. Motor vehicles and bombers did not reinvent the military geography of Europe during World War II. After the age of Napoleon, no southern European power on the Mediterranean was able on its own to match northern European nations. World War II was again no exception. Italy was the first of the Axis to capitulate. The Iberians wisely stayed out of the war. Greece was easily defeated by the Germans. North Africans were largely spectators to lethal European warfare taking place in their midst. Turkey remained neutral for most of the war. If World War II was fought across the globe, its ultimate course was still largely determined by northern European states and their former colonies in a way that was true of all European wars since the late 18th century. Over 2,400 years ago, the historian Thucydides had emphasized the military advantages of sea powers, particularly their ability to control commerce and move troops. Not much had changed since antiquity, as the oceans likewise mattered a great deal to the six major belligerents in World War II. Three great powers were invaded during the war: Germany, Italy, and Russia. Three were not: America, Britain, and Japan. All the former were on the European landmass. The latter were either islands or distant and bounded by two vast oceans. Amphibious operations originating on the high seas were a far more difficult matter than crossing borders, or in the case of Italy, crossing from Sicily onto the mainland. The protection afforded Great Britain and the United States by surrounding seas meant that containing the German threat was never the existential challenge for them that it always was for the Western Europeans. The generals of the French may have always appeared cranky to the Anglo-Americans, but then neither Britain nor America had a common border with Germany. The only way for Germany to strike Britain was to invade and occupy the French and Belgian coasts, as reflected both in the German September Programme of 1914 and in Hitler's obsessions with the Atlantic ports between 1940 and 1945. Since the 15th century, European countries that faced the Atlantic had natural advantages over those whose chief home ports were confined to the North, Baltic, and Mediterranean seas. Even if weaker than Germany, the islands of Japan nevertheless made an Allied invasion a far more difficult proposition than would crossing the Rhine or Oder into Germany. In fact, no modern power had ever completed a successful invasion of the Japanese homeland, a fact well known to Allied planners who wished to, and did, avoid the prospect through dominant air power. Japan's various strategic choices in 1941 were predicated a great deal on traditional geographical considerations. Japan could further reinforce its decade-long presence in China, or in June 1941 join Hitler by attacking the Soviet Union from the east, or absorb orphaned colonial territory in the Pacific, or allow the Imperial Navy to begin new wars against the United States and Britain because it was an island sea power with few immediate worries about ground invasions or enemy amphibious landings. Left unspoken was the fact that in almost all these geographical scenarios, an often xenophobic and resource-hungry Japan had few friends. It had alienated the Western powers during the 1930s, invaded China in 1937, fought the Soviets in 1939, and been aggressive toward India. It was disliked and distrusted in the Pacific and unable to partner effectively with its own Axis allies. Any eastward expansion of 20th century Japan into the Pacific depended also on the status of its western geography. If either Russia or China were to be hostile, and both usually were, by definition Japan would be faced with an uninviting two-front war. In World War II, the bulk of Japanese ground forces, over 600,000 at any given time, was fighting in China, where over a half million Japanese soldiers eventually perished. Japan was willing to risk a two-front war after its non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union in April 1941, given that the Chinese front was mostly stalemated. But it never envisioned the possibility that Pearl Harbor would lead to a three-theater conflict in which Japan would be fighting China, the United States, and finally the Russians. Because pulling out of the Chinese morass was deemed unacceptable by the government of General and Prime Minister Hideki Tojo, and given that the Imperial Japanese Army had already fared poorly against the Russians from 1932 to 1939 along the Mongolian border, Japan felt its best choice of aggression was a surprise preemptory naval air attack on the geographically distant Americans, who allegedly might soon have attacked Japan or would eventually have strangled its importation of key resources. General Tojo told the Japanese War Cabinet that he had thought of all the alternatives until it makes my head ache, but the conclusion always is that war is unavoidable. Weather was also never superseded by 20th century technology, but as in ancient times it often shaped the battlefield, as it had in the storms that sank much of King Xerxes' fleet at Artemisium during the Persian invasion of Greece, 480 BC, the scorching heat that sapped the Crusaders at Hattin, 1187, and cost them a catastrophic defeat against Saladin and the Muslims, or the rain-soaked ground that hampered Napoleon's artillery and cavalry movements in his defeat at Waterloo, 1815. To the end of the war, Germans argued that the early and unusually harsh winter of 1941 had robbed them of two critical weeks at Moscow, and when that window closed, so did any chance of victory. Inhuman cold stymied airlifts to German troops at Stalingrad, and the attempts at evacuation of units that became surrounded there. Fog stalled airborne reinforcements to British forces at Arnhem in 1944, contributing to the German repulse of a major Allied initiative. Strong winds and clouds, in part, forced General Curtis LeMay to change tactics by taking his B-29s to lower elevations and dropping incendiary rather than general-purpose bombs, thereby setting Tokyo afire with napalm. Generals and admirals, like their ancient counterparts, often predictably blamed the weather for their failures, as if they assumed in their plans that nature should be predictably compliant rather than fickle and savage. By 1939, Germany had entered its third European war within 70 years, following World War I, 1914 to 1918, and before that, the Franco-Prussian War, 1870 and 1871. Conflicts throughout history become serial when an enemy is not utterly defeated and is not forced to submit to the political conditions of the victor, whether in the two Peloponnesian or three Punic Wars, or the later Hundred Years and 7 Years Wars. Such was the case with the preludes to World War II, when many of the major familiar nations of the European world were again at war. Germany was once more the aggressor. That fact also helped spawn the familiar idea of World War II and its alternative designation, the Second World War. Yet this time around, both sides tacitly agreed that there would not be a World War III. Either Germany would finally achieve its near-century-long dream of European dominance, or cease to exist as a national socialist state and military power. Yet the Allies understood history far better. In any existential war, only the side that has the ability to destroy the homeland of the other wins. The war, also like many conflicts of the past, was certainly chronologically inexact, with two official denouements known in the Anglosphere as VE and VJ Day. The war, like many, was also ill-defined, especially for a country such as Bulgaria, to take one minor example, which had no common interests or communications with its nominal Pacific ally Japan. Likewise, the Greeks were indifferent to the war against fascism in China, and in the same way the Soviet Union cared little whether Italy had invaded France. Often border disputes on the periphery of Germany, ethnic hatreds in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, and political grievances and national ambitions set off regional wars that were only with hindsight lumped altogether as World War II, at least in Britain and the United States. Most sides had hopes of allying their parochial causes to larger ideological crusades. But far more important, they just wanted to join the right side of strong allies that might be likely winners and divvy up spoils. General Francisco Franco's fascist government in Spain was emblematic of such opportunism that transcended ideological affinities. During 1939 to 1941, Franco, despite horrendous recent losses in the Spanish Civil War, and despite Hitler's occasional rebuffs, considered possible entrance into the war on the Axis side. Franco assumed that the Allies would likely be defeated and there might be colonial spoils in North Africa allotted to Spain. He often boasted that Spain might unilaterally take Gibraltar or enlist hundreds of thousands of warriors to the Axis cause. But between 1943 and 1944, Spain increasingly began to reassert its neutrality in recognition that the Axis powers would now likely lose the war and their war-won territories, and prior allegiance might earn an Allied invasion and with it a change of government. By late 1944, fascist Spain was no longer exporting tungsten to Germany and was instead reinvented as sympathetic to British and American democracy and eager to become an anti-communist ally after the war. At any given time, any given people, the Finns in 1939, the Italians, Russians, and Chinese in 1940, the Americans in summer 1941, found it difficult to define the world war that had really been triggered by the German invasion of Poland. After the war began in 1939, America imposed a boycott on the Soviet Union over its surprise invasion of Finland, only soon to reverse course and provide arms to the once blacklisted Russians to defeat the once noble victim, Finland. Both Britain and Germany had long courted Italy and the Soviet Union as allies, and vice versa. Japan occupied Vichy-held Indochina, although both Japan and Vichy France were nominal allies of Germany. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin signed pacts or came to formal and informal agreements of non-aggression with all the major belligerents at one time or another. What qualifies a conflict as a world war? Despite its title, World War I had never really been truly global. Africa was largely left out of it, save for small regional battles in the interior and the hundreds of thousands of Africans who joined colonial armies in Europe and the Middle East. Outside of the Middle East and Turkey, mainland Asia was also mostly immune from the carnage. There was little frequent surface fighting on the high seas, apart from the waters around Europe and Britain, and in the Mediterranean. Air power was in its infancy. Neither North American nor Australian territory was attacked. The Arctic saw little combat. In fact, until 1941, there had never been a global war. Even the bloodiest wars of the past were theater conflicts. The so-called Persian Wars, 490 to 479 BC, were really only about the annexation of Ionia and the Greek mainland as the westernmost provinces of the Persian Empire. Alexander the Great fought a Greek, Asian, and North African war, 335 to 323 BC, yet left the western Mediterranean alone. Carthage versus Rome was mostly a Mediterranean affair that drew in only local North African tribesmen, southern Europeans, and the vestiges of Macedonian power in Greece, 264 to 146 BC. The Crusades were essentially one-dimensional campaigns across the eastern Mediterranean to the Middle East. The Hundred Years' War, 1337 to 1453, or the destructive American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, never became global. Rome's legions and galleys from the 1st and 2nd centuries BC had been deployed in Africa, Western Europe, Asia, and throughout the Mediterranean, but they did not fight all at once and not much elsewhere. Although Winston Churchill described the Seven Years' War, 1754 and/or 1756 to 1763, as the First World War, it was not, given that China and Japan were not involved, and most peoples in India, Asia, South America, and Africa were only tangentially affected. Napoleon's 12 years of warring, 1803 to 1815, perhaps came closest to becoming a worldwide conflict among dozens of enemies. Its subsidiary and affiliated conflicts spread beyond Europe and Russia to some major fighting in North Africa, the Middle East, the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, and North America. Perhaps 5 million perished in the two decades of the Napoleonic Wars. But in general, the idea of world wars has been absent in history. Even the few intercontinental conflicts that took place were not necessarily any more destructive than more frequent border conflicts. World War II changed all that. Only in retrospect did historians and veterans begin to equate the various wars around the world between 1939, or perhaps as early as 1931 to 1937 in the case of Japan, and 1945 as part of a thematic conflict. And yet, not everywhere. The French, who were defeated in June 1940, never warmed to the idea of a World War II that they had bowed out of for 4 years. The Soviets, who believed that they alone had defeated Nazi Germany, which was the only real focus of their war, saw the Great Patriotic War as theirs alone. But then in the past, the Tsars likewise had used the same self-referential nomenclature for their patriotic wars against Napoleon of France and Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany. Such reformulations and rebranding happened frequently throughout history. The Peloponnesian War, for example, was an invention largely of Thucydides in the late 5th century BC. Unlike many of his contemporaries, the Athenian veteran and ex-admiral saw in hindsight that lots of successive wars and interludes, the Archidamian War, the Peace of Nicias, The Sicilian War, the Decelian War, and the Ionian War were all fought between 431 and 404 BC as a single, if episodic, conflict. The decade-long Persian Wars and the century-long Punic Wars likewise came to be known in such comprehensive fashion only after the final battles, in the defeat of Persia and Carthage, respectively. In that sense, some have seen World War II as properly part of a continual transatlantic versus German 30 Years War that broke out in 1914, quieted down in 1918, then went through Thucydidean cycles of calm and tension before being renewed in 1939 and ended, it seems, for good in 1945. Confusion characterized preludes to war during the 1930s. Initially, the democracies had naively assumed that even non-democratic European nations, such as Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, might at least share a common age-old Western religion, pedigree, and history, and thus be familiar, somewhat rational, and have no desire to repeat the appalling bloodletting of the Somme and Verdun in 1916. Given the tragedy of World War I, Hitler's Germany surely would appreciate the need for negotiation and concessions, and thus agree to iron out differences through diplomacy, without again resorting to suicidal violence. Such patience and naivete only eroded classical deterrence and encouraged further Nazi aggrandizement. Most wars since antiquity can be defined as the result of such flawed pre-war assessments of relative military and economic strength, as well as strategic objectives. Pre-war Nazi Germany had no accurate idea of how powerful were Great Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, and the latter had no inkling of the full scope of Hitler's military ambitions. It took a world war to educate them all. Throughout history, conflict had always broken out between enemies when the appearance of deterrence, the material and spiritual likelihood of using greater military power successfully against an aggressive enemy, vanished. From Carthage to the Confederacy, weaker bellicose states could convince themselves of the impossible because their fantasies were not checked earlier by cold reality. A stronger appearance of power, and of the willingness to employ it, might have stopped more conflicts before they began. Put another way, deterrence in the famous formulation of the 17th century British statesman George Saville, 1st Marquess of Halifax, meant that men are not hanged for stealing horses, but that horses may not be stolen. But once thieves were not hanged and more horses were indeed stolen, who is strong and who weak became confusing, and the proper recalibration that pruned rhetoric and posturing from knowledge of real strength returned only at the tremendous cost of a world war. Hitler's Mein Kampf, the new Quran of faith and war, according to Winston Churchill, was in truth a puerile rant that gained credence only through German rearmament and aggressiveness, at least before Stalingrad. After that battle, Hitler was no longer read widely and was only rarely heard by Germans, as the ambitions of the Third Reich waned and Nazi Germany was exposed as far weaker than its enemies and led by an incompetent strategist. The pre-war reality was that Russian armor was superior to German. Inexplicably, the Soviets had not been able to communicate that fact, and in consequence lost deterrence. Hitler later remarked that had he just been made aware of the nature of Russian tank production, and specifically about the T-34 tank, against which standard German anti-tank weapons were ineffective, he would never have invaded the Soviet Union. Maybe. But it took a theater war in the East that killed over 30 million people to reveal the Soviets' real power. Accordingly, leaders and their followers are forced to make the necessary readjustments, although often at a terrible price of correcting flawed pre-war impressions. In the case of the timidity of the Western democracies in 1938 and 1939, General Walter Vorlamont explained Hitler's confidence about powers that easily could have deterred Germany. One, he felt there, the Allies, far eastern interests were more important than their European interests, and two, they did not appear to be armed sufficiently. What a terrible cost ensued to prove Hitler wrong. Only after the disastrous battles of Leipzig, 1813, and Waterloo, 1815, did Napoleon finally concede that his armies had never been a match for the combined strength of Russia, Prussia, Austria, Sweden, and England. Had all those states combined in a firm coalition a decade earlier, Napoleon might well have been deterred. Churchill, without much exaggeration, said of Hitler's military agenda, Up till 1934 at least, German rearmament could have been prevented without the loss of a single life. It was not time that was lacking. By any fair measure, Germany in 1939, in terms of the number and quality of planes, armor, manpower reserves, and industrial output, was not stronger than the combined French and British militaries, or at least not so strong as to be able to defeat and occupy both powers. The later German-Italian-Japanese axis was far less impressive than the alliance that would soon emerge of Great Britain, America, and Russia, having only little over a third of the three allies' combined populations, not to speak of their productive capacity. After all, the United States, by war's end in 1945, would achieve a wartime gross national product nearly greater than that of all the other Allied and Axis powers combined. In sum, 60 million dead, 20th-century totalitarian ideologies, the singular evil of Adolf Hitler, the appearance of V-2 rockets, the dropping of two atomic bombs, the Holocaust, napalm, kamikazes, and the slaughter of millions in Russia and China seemed to redefine World War II as unlike any conflict of the past, even as predictable humans with unchanging characteristics, fighting amid age-old geography and weather patterns, continued to follow the ancient canons of war and replayed roles well known from the ages. Why the Western world, which was aware of the classical lessons and geography of war, and was still suffering from the immediate trauma of the First World War, chose to tear itself apart in 1939, is a story not so much of accidents, miscalculations, and overreactions, although there were plenty of those to be sure, as of the carefully considered decisions to ignore, appease, or collaborate with Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany by nations that had the resources and knowledge, but not yet the willpower to do otherwise. 2. Grievances, agendas, and methods. The causes of World War II were many. Age-old border and national grievances sparked tensions. There was not just general unhappiness of both the winners and losers of World War I over the Versailles Treaty that had supposedly ended the conflict and established a lasting peace, but also real furor at a settlement variously labeled as either too soft or too hard, and increasingly seen on all sides as unsustainable. Neither of the prior two German wars, the Franco-Prussian War and World War I, had solved the perennial problem of a unified, dynamic, and nationalistic Germany in the heart of Europe. And by the 1930s, these tensions were energized by 20th-century fascist technologies and ideologies. The result was a veritable fantasy land that grew up in the late 1930s in both Europe and Asia, in which citizens of the intrinsically weaker Axis powers, both industrially and technologically, were considered supermen, while real Allied supermen lost their confidence and were despised by their enemies as unserious lightweights. What followed was the central tragic irony of World War II. The weaker Axis powers proved incapable of defeating their Allied enemies on the field of battle, but nevertheless were more adept at killing far more of them and their civilian populations. World War II is one of the few major wars in history in which the losing side killed far more soldiers than did the winners, and far more civilians died than soldiers. And rarely in past conflicts had the losers of a war initially won so much so quickly, with far less material and human resources than was available to the eventual winners. In sum, World War II started in a bizarre fashion, progressed even more unpredictably, and, in the technological sense, ended in nightmarish ways never before envisioned. The shock of the war was not just its historic devastation and brutality, but that such unprecedented savagery appeared a logical dividend of 20th-century technology and ideology, a century in which enlightened elites had promised at last an end to all wars and shared global peacekeeping as well as new machines and customs to make life wealthier, more secure, and more enjoyable than at any time in history. World War II is generally regarded to have begun on September 1, 1939. Germany invaded Poland, for the third time in 70 years, crossing the borders of its European neighbors. Hitler's aggression prompted a declaration of war on Germany by Britain 2 days later. Most of the British Empire and France joined in, at least in theory. 17 days later, the Soviet Red Army, assured that it would not be fighting Japan simultaneously, entered Poland to divide the spoils of this ruined and soon-to-disappear nation with Nazi Germany. The later axis of Germany, Italy, and Japan had participated in small wars prior to September 1939 in Spain, Abyssinia, and Manchuria, but none of those aggressions, nor even the Nazi 1938 and 1939 absorption of much of Czechoslovakia, had prompted a collective military response from the European democracies. Throughout history, larger states have more frequently blamed their smaller and often distant allies for entangling them in wars than they have rushed to prevent or end those wars. In 1938, few in Paris or London had wished to die for Czechoslovakia, or to stop the Axis agenda of incrementally absorbing borderlands far from the Western capitals. In September 1939, few wanted to fight for Poland, at least if they believed that the war itself would end with the end of Poland. The Soviet ambassador to Britain, Ivan Maisky, recorded a conversation in November 1939 he had with Lord Beaverbrook, who illustrated British fears just 10 weeks into the war. "I'm an isolationist. What concerns me is the fate of the British Empire. I want the Empire to remain intact, but I don't understand why, for the sake of this, we must wage a 3-year war to crush Hitlerism. To hell with that man, Hitler. If the Germans want him, I happily concede them this treasure and make my bow. Poland, Czechoslovakia, what are they to do with us? Cursed be the day when Chamberlain gave our guarantees to Poland." If recorded accurately, Beaverbrook's words were in fact not that different from Hitler's own initial feelings about Britain, which, he felt, should have stayed out of a European land war, kept its empire, and made a deal with the Third Reich about their respective hegemonies. "The English are behaving as if they were stupid. The reality will end by calling them to order, by compelling them to open their eyes. Being neutral is by design a choice, with results that either harm or hurt the particular belligerents in question, with neutrality almost always aiding the aggressive carnivore, not its victim." Or as the Indian statesman and activist V.K. Krishnamenon cynically once put it, "There can be no more positive neutrality than there can be a vegetarian tiger." Still, Hitler was for a moment dumbfounded. Unpleasantly surprised, in the words of Winston Churchill, that the supposedly enfeebled allies had, at least nominally, declared war over Poland. It was natural that Hitler should be taken aback, given the fact that his new non-aggression pact, signed with the Soviet Union on August 23, 1939, had eliminated, he had hoped, the specter of a World War I-like two-front continental war. After all, Poland's fate had always been to be divvied up, given that it had been partitioned on at least 4 previous occasions. Hitler soon recovered as he sensed that even though the Allies had declared war, there was little likelihood that they would ever wage it wholeheartedly. Moreover, Hitler envisioned something different for Poland, not just a quick defeat, but the annihilation of the state altogether in a manner that would be harsh and remorseless. Poland would disappear before the dithering Allies could do much about it, and would teach them of the unpredictable nihilism of the Third Reich. Yet the duplicitous German and Russian attack on Poland, digested over the ensuing 8 months of occupation, slowly did change ideas of going to war in France and Britain. Poland's quick end was seen as the final provocation in a long series of Hitler's aggressive acts that had left the Western enemies of Germany deeply angered, but also abjectly embarrassed and terribly afraid. For the shamed Western Europeans who were, for a time, snapped out of their lethargy, Hitler's stopping at Poland in September 1939 was suddenly seen to be as unlikely as the earlier beliefs that the Nazis would have ceased their aggressions after Germany's 1938 annexations of Austria or the Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia's German-speaking areas bordering Germany and Austria. Certainly Hitler had an agenda that transcended even that of the Kaisers, and that could not be accommodated through concessions and diplomacy. The combined invasion of Poland also destroyed the unspoken democratic assumption that the evils of Nazism nonetheless would prove useful in shielding the West from the savagery of Russian Bolshevism. If Hitler had now made arrangements with the Soviet Union, then little was left of the amoral realpolitik that had excused Nazi brutality in exchange for keeping Stalinism away from the Western democracies. Hitler went to the trouble of dropping leaflets over Britain to convince the British not to see the loss of Poland as a legitimate cause to pursue their declared war against Germany. but the potential for a wider war was already looming. Aside from the pivotal global role of the British Empire, there were soon alliances with and enemies against Germany on several continents, Australia, Asia, North America, and eventually South America. Nations declared war on one another without full appreciation of the long-range potential of any of them to conduct a world war. This time around, the conflict grew far wider and far more deadly than in 1914, in part because the War of 1939 soon transcended the 19th-century European problem of containing the continental agendas of a dynamic, united, and aggrieved Imperial Germany, and technology had reduced both time and space. The new war after 1941 involved the political futures of hundreds of millions, far beyond the paths of the Rhine and Oder, and on all the continents, as battles on rare occasions reached the Arctic, Australia, and even South America. At one time or another, most of the world's greatest cities, Amsterdam, Antwerp, Athens, Berlin, Budapest, Leningrad, London, Moscow, Paris, Prague, Rome, Rotterdam, Shanghai, Singapore, Tokyo, Vienna, Warsaw, and Yokohama could be reached by either bombers or armor and were thus either bombed or besieged. By 1945, almost every nation in the world, with only 11 remaining neutral, was involved in the conflict. A strange confluence of events had not made the pre-war reality of German, Italian, and Japanese collective weakness clear to the Allied powers until perhaps late 1942, after the victories at Stalingrad, El Alamein, and Guadalcanal. That was some time after Adolf Hitler, then Benito Mussolini, and finally the Japanese militarists led by Hideki Tojo, had foolishly gambled otherwise in Russia, the Balkans, and the Pacific, earning the odd Allied alliance of common resistance against them. The Germans and Italians had cheaply earned the reputation of immense power by intervening successfully against a weak loyalist army in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. They had showcased their late-model planes, artillery, and tanks, rightly seen as cutting-edge in the late 1930s, but rarely acknowledged as near obsolete by 1941. Their power seemed to have illustrated to the world a desire to use brute force recklessly and to ignore moral objections or civilian casualties. Franco's nationalists had won. The loyalists, backed mostly by the Soviet Union and by Western volunteers, had lost. The Axis paradigm, at least in terms of infrastructure and armaments, seemed initially to have survived the Great Depression better than had the democracies of Western Europe and, in particular, the United States. In truth, America, for all its economic follies, had probably done as well as Germany in combating the Depression, even though Hitler's showy public works projects received far more attention. Confident Axis powers boasted of a new motorized war to come on the ground and above. This gospel seemed confirmed by a parade to Berlin of visiting American and British military experts, from aviator Charles Lindbergh to British tank guru J.F.C. Fuller. Most were hypnotized by Nazi braggadocio and pageantry rather than examination of precise armament output and relative quality of weapons. Few guessed that the hugely costly Nazi rearmament between 1934 and 1939 had nearly bankrupted the Third Reich, but still had not given it parity in heavy bombers or capital ships with its likely enemies. Mussolini and Hitler were far more frenzied leaders than those in Western Europe and America, and were able to feign a madness that was a valuable asset in pre-war geopolitical poker. Both were wounded and bemedaled combat veterans of World War I from the enlisted ranks. A generation later, they now posed as authentic brawlers more willing to fight than their more rational Western Allied counterparts, who were led by aristocrats of the 1930s who had either been administrators or officers in the First World War. The antitheses were reminiscent of the historian Thucydides' warning about the insurrection on the island of Corcyra, where the successful blunter wits were more ready for prompt action than their more sophisticated opponents. By the 1930s, the aftermath of the so-called Great War had given birth to a sense of fatalism among the generation of its non-commissioned veterans. In almost all of Hitler's nocturnal rantings, he invoked the realism of the trenches of World War I. but in terms in which that nightmare steeled character rather than counseled caution. His lessons were quite different from the surrealism and occasional dark absurdity of Guillaume Apollinaire, Wilfred Owen, and Siegfried Sassoon, whose anti-war work found far larger international audiences than did that of their German counterparts. Perhaps more philosophical victors could afford to reflect on the war in its properly horrendous landscape. Dejected losers by needs both romanticized their doomed bravery and found scapegoats for their defeat. To the extent that they were prepared, the Allies for much of the 1920s and early 1930s seemed resigned, at least tactically, to refight the return of another huge, slow-moving German army. They feared a future conflict as another mass collision of infantries plodding across the trenches, a conflict they had nonetheless won. As a result of such anxiety, the reconstituted Allied powers in theory sought solutions to the Somme and Verdun in mobility and machines to avoid a return of the trenches. In reality, the preparations of those nations closest to Germany, such as France and Czechoslovakia, were more marked by reactionary static defensive fortifications. Concrete was impressive and of real value, but antithetical to the spirit of the mobile age and the doctrine of muscular retaliation. A geriatric French officer class and lack of tactical innovation and coordination meant that even had the Germans' main thrust targeted the concrete fortifications of the Maginot Line, it might well have succeeded. The Depression-era democracies were also without confidence that their industrial potential would ever again be fully harnessed, as it had been in 1918, to produce superior offensive weapons in great numbers. The 1920s were a time for finally enjoying the much-deserved peace dividend, not for more sacrifices brought on by rearmament that could only lead to endless war with the same European players. Luftwaffe head Hermann Göring scoffed to the American news correspondent William Scherer in Berlin in November 1939, just 2 months after the invasion of Poland. "If we could only make planes at your rate of production, we should be very weak. I mean that seriously. Your planes are good, but you don't make enough of them fast enough." Göring typically was quite wrong, but his errors at least reflected the German sense that the Allies had lost the power of deterrence, which is predicated not just on material strength, but the appearance of it and the acknowledged willingness to use it. Even today, few note that French, British, and American plane production together in 1939 already exceeded that of Italy and Germany. The British were already flying Early Stirling, first flight May 1939, and Handley Page, first flight October 1939, four-engine bomber prototypes, and the Americans were producing early model B-17s delivered as early as 1937. These antecedents were slow and sometimes unreliable, especially the British aircraft, but they gave the Allies early pathways to the use of heavy bombers that would soon be followed with improved and entirely new models. Most important, Allied aircraft factories were already gearing up to meet or exceed German fighter and bomber designs, even before America entered the war. Later, the delusional Göring himself would deny that Allied fighter escorts could ever reach German airspace, at a time when they were routinely flying through it and were occasionally shot down inside the Third Reich. No matter. Almost every public proclamation that the Allies had voiced in the 1920s and early 1930s projected at least an appearance of timidity that invited war from what were still relatively weak powers. For the decade after Versailles, France, Britain, and the United States scaled back their militaries, all sought international agreements, the Washington Naval Conference, 1921 and 1922, the Dawes Plan, 1924, the Locarno Treaties, 1925, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, 1928, and the London Naval Conference, 1930, to tweak the Versailles Treaty, to limit arms on land and sea, to pledge peaceful intentions to one another, to showcase their virtue, to profess invincible solidarity, and even to declare war itself obsolete, anything other than to rebuild military power to shock and deter Germany. The prior victors and stronger powers yearned for collective security in the League of Nations. The former losers and weaker nations talked about unilateral action and utopian organs of international peace. Democratic elites reinterpreted the success of stopping Germany and Austria in World War I as an ambiguous exercise without true winners and losers. Germans studied how clear losers like themselves could become unquestioned winners like their former enemies. By the late 1920s, the victors of World War I were still arguing over whether the disaster had been caused as much by renegade international arms merchants as by aggressive Germans. Profit-mongering capitalists, archaic alliances, mindless automatic mobilizations, greedy bankers, and simple miscalculations and accidents were the supposed culprits, not the inability in 1914 once again to have deterred forceful Prussian militarism and German megalomania. British and French statesmen dreamed that Hitler might be an economic rationalist and that new trade concessions could dampen his martial ardor, or that he might be a realist who could see that a new world war would cost Germany dearly, or they downplayed Nazi racialist ideology as some sort of crass public veneer that hid logical German agendas, or they saw Hitler as a useful and transitory tool for venting the frustrations of soberer German capitalists, aristocrats, and the Junker class. Or they believed National Socialism was a nasty but effective deterrent to Bolshevism. Consequently, when Chancellor Hitler acquired absolute power and was ratified as Führer on August 29, 1934, Allied statesmen assumed that the Germans would soon tire of their failed painter and Austrian corporal. Elites sometimes equate someone's prior failure to gain social status or receive a graduate degree or make money with incompetence or a lack of talent. Yet the pathetic socialist pamphleteer and failed novelist Benito Mussolini and the thuggish seminary dropout, bank robber, and would-be essayist Joseph Stalin, traditional failures all, proved nonetheless in nihilistic times to be astute political operatives far more gifted than most of their gentleman counterparts in the European democracies of the 1930s. The British statesman Anthony Eden lamented that few in Britain had ever encountered anyone quite like Hitler or Mussolini. "You know, the hardest thing for me during that time was to convince my friends that Hitler and Mussolini were quite different from British businessmen or country gentlemen as regards their psychology, motivations, and modes of action. My friends simply refused to believe me. They thought I was biased against the dictators and refused to understand them. I kept saying, 'When you converse with the Führer or the Duce, you feel at once that you are dealing with an animal of an entirely different breed from yourself.'" The Western democracies at first failed to appreciate the extent to which Hitler's string of earlier spectacular diplomatic successes and easy initial blitzkrieg victories enthralled a depressed German people proud of a profound artistic and intellectual heritage. Cultured as they might have been, millions of the folk saw no contradiction between high culture and the base tenets of a national socialism that steamrolled its opponents. Or if anything, perhaps they sensed a symbiosis between the power of the German armed forces, the Wehrmacht, and the supremacy of Western civilization, as Hitler himself often ranted about opera, art, and architecture as the fruits of his victories deep into the night to his small captive dinner audiences. Panzer Commander Hans von Luch related just such a cultural-military intersection even during the dark December 1944 German retreat from the old Maginot Line on the French border. As Luke walked among the ruins of a bombed-out church in the heat of battle, he suddenly saw an organ and immediately showed himself to be a soldier of culture and sensitivity. "Through a gaping hole in the wall we went in. I stood facing the altar, which lay in ruins, and looked up at the organ. It seemed to be unharmed. A few more of our men came in. 'Come,' I called to a lance corporal, 'we'll climb up to the organ.' On arriving above, I asked the man to tread the bellows. I sat down at the organ and, it was hardly believable, it worked. On the spur of the moment I began to play Bach's chorale, Nun danket alle Gott. It resounded through the ruins to the outside. There was no apparent disconnect between fighting to protect National Socialist Germany and seeking to play Bach amid the wreckage of battle." Emotions push states to war as much as does greed. Materialists might argue that all three resource-starved Axis powers simply went to war for more natural wealth, ores, rubber, food stocks, and especially fuels. They wanted additional territory that belonged to someone else, usually someone weaker, in order to expand their influence and population beyond their recognized borders. Yet it did no good to point out to National Socialist leaders that Germany's large population, robust industry, and relatively little damage from the Great War made it likely to resume its role as a European powerhouse even without, for example, incorporating Austria, the Sudetenland, and western Poland. Nor would Hitler believe by late August 1939 that the Third Reich was already in Germany's best geostrategic position since its founding, with its largest population and territory since the birth of the German state. Germany had far more territory in September 1939 than it has today, with a similarly sized population. There was no longer a hostile Tsarist Russian Empire. There was no rivalry within Austria-Hungary, no antagonistic and interventionist United States. France and Britain were both willing to compromise. Nazi Germany freely bought oil on the open market, often from North America. It had either renegotiated or reneged on, without consequences, any international agreement that it felt detrimental to its expansionist agenda. Germans were not starving. Lebensraum, we demand land and territory for the nourishment of our people and for settling our surplus population, was not based on an existing shortage of arable land. Likewise, it would have been fruitless to point out that Japan did not need half of China to fuel its industries, or that the backward areas of East and North Africa were not the answer to Italy's chronically weak economy. Instead, all three fascist powers resented, in varying degrees, and especially during the hard times of the early 1930s, the Versailles Treaty and its aftermath, especially that their honor had been impugned and their peoples had not received respect and commensurate deserts. They went to war to earn global power and especially to be recognized as globally powerful.